All right. Well, I'm really excited about this series. We can get seated about this series in general, but specifically about this event. I'll do my sort of normal introduction of the congressman, but then I want to share a quick story as well. So I think all of you know who Congressman Diaz-Balart is. He's currently fulfilling his 11th term in the U.S. House of Representatives. He right now represents the 26th Congressional District of Florida. He is a senior member on the House Committee on Appropriations. He's chairman of the State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Subcommittee. He serves on the Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Committee and Defense Subcommittees. Prior to his time in Congress, he was also in the Florida State Legislature on both the House and Senate side and studied political science at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And I know some young folks here who were political science majors too. So this is the kind of career that you can have from that degree. Yeah.
Don't.
If this is what you want, then go for
it. Yeah, you're dissuading them from doing this anymore. Right,
exactly. But on a sort of small personal note, when I was in the previous administration, I was working for Elliott as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Cuba and Venezuela. And I just want to say Congressman Diaz-Balart was one of, actually the only member of Congress who regularly would reach out, ask me my ideas, seek to engage with me, share his ideas. And it was so unbelievably helpful to me. This was my first job in government. And I was shocked that there was this member of Congress that was like asking what I thought about things. And that meant the world to me. So thank you so much for that. And I think it speaks to your specific style of leadership, your willingness to engage not just with other members of, you know, government, but also with your constituents, which is, I think, why you've been such a successful member of Congress. So
thank you so very much. What a privilege. What a privilege.
So I was going to ask a different question, but in light of what's happening today on
Capitol
Hill.
Is something going on in Capitol Hill today?
Just a couple of things happening. So what is happening? And my first question is, what is happening? Why is it happening? And how can
we fix it? It was nice being here. Thank you very much. Karen, but by the way, if you allow me before we start, and Elliot, when I heard that you all were doing this, I was so excited. And thank you for the opportunity to spend this time with you and with all of you, because as I just said to both of them when I walked in, they are a sight for sore eyes. I believe that the United States and the world is safer when the United States leads with humility, but with strength and with conviction. These two have shown and proven what that means. And I think something that's really, really lacking right now, and the world is in flames, and we can talk about why, but U.S. leadership matters. And I'll tell you what, you know, a lifetime of service, you as well, even though we're a lot younger than him, And so thank you for what you are doing, for doing this, and each and every one of you for also understanding the importance of having a foreign policy that again, that demonstrates real leadership, unapologetic real leadership, because I don't have to tell you all that the one thing that has never worked in the history of humanity, that has never kept anybody safe, is appeasement. And if you look at what's happening right now, this is the master of appeasement, is what we're saying. And so thank you for what you've done, and what a privilege to be with you. So thank you for allowing me to get that out, because I'm so grateful to both of you. So thank you.
Great. I noticed that you dodged the question.
I was
very political of you.
Yeah, I was hoping the filibuster would work, damn it. Look, it's interesting. You know, we have a new speaker, and we have a new speaker who I will tell you, I would readily admit, I knew, didn't know him well. This is a person who is a real, serious, unapologetic conservative, you know, Reagan conservative. And everybody, I mean, you know, when you saw him when he got elected, everybody was conceding that, right? And I'm talking about my colleagues and even folks out in the press, potentially the most conservative speaker in the history of this country. Knowledgeable, smart, conservative. And he has been doing what he knows is the right thing for the national security and for the economic stability and betterment of the American people. But he's in a position that it doesn't matter what he does, there's going to be some who will criticize him, and that's okay. But it's getting to the point now where it's no longer criticism. It's frankly threatening him and threatening his position. And I will tell you, what that's doing, it's derailing the conservative agenda. It's derailing real conservative victories. And we all know that in a democracy, you can't get 100%. But the speaker has done an amazing job getting conservative victories while only controlling, well, actually, while almost controlling the House, and obviously not controlling the Senate and the White House. And so it's unfortunate that what he is now proposing, because there are differences of opinion, we'll get into that. What he's proposing now is something that some of the people that are now criticizing him have said that they wanted, which is individual bills, separate votes on those bills, allow amendments to be discussed. But now, the exact same things that individuals have been demanding, those individuals that were demanding those things are now threatening to, in essence, take him out because he's actually doing what they asked him to do. And so it's an unwinnable position. I will tell you, it's not that I'm always going to agree with the speaker, but he's an honorable man. He's a decent man. He's a real conservative trying to move conservative principles. And I think when the world is in flames, this is not the time to try to become a celebrity or to try to get clicks on social media or to try to raise money off of it. This is a time to stand unified. And unfortunately, that's not what we're seeing right now in the House. So
one of the problems with unity, at least within the Republican Party, is Ukraine, obviously.
Yeah.
This has been a challenge for the Republican Party to get behind. You've obviously been a very strong advocate for continuing military aid to Ukraine. What do you see as happening should we fail to provide that aid to Ukraine, both as it relates to Russia's ambitions, but also as it relates to Iran, China, yeah, and other regimes around the world like Venezuela?
I don't want to age myself. Whoa. Wow. I don't want to age myself, but, you know, there was a time not that long ago when Republicans, frankly, 100% of us were complaining and trying to do what we could when President Obama was unwilling to fund the Ukrainians. The Republicans are the ones that were demanding that we not only send blankets and, you know, sunscreen, but that we also sent weapons to protect the Ukraine, to protect Crimea. It was Republicans who, when after Putin, by the way, doing what he said he was going to do, invaded Georgia. You'll recall that it was the Democrats who, after the invasion of Georgia, remember the little reset button incident? When the then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went, met with the Russians and said, it's okay. You just invaded Georgia, but it's okay. It's okay. And it was Republicans who consistently, I thought it was the right thing to do, said, hey, you know, this is not going to end well. When you have a thug, a gangster, who threatens and says that, and it's not just Georgia and the Baltics and Poland, right? He's been very consistent that he considers all of that to be part of, in essence, his territory, right? And then has been willing to act on it. It was Republicans who kept saying to the Democrats, appeasement, which is what you're doing, will not work, and it didn't work. All of a sudden, you have a small group of Republicans. And by the way, let's be very clear, I respect people having different points of view. But there's been a shift. From basically, I think, almost total unanimous support for stopping Putin from doing what he's been saying that he's going to do. And it was the Democrats who were willing to appease and frankly not do anything. You'll recall that it got to the point where, remember that Georgia had troops fighting side by side with American troops in Afghanistan. And President Obama, in order to try to appease Putin, actually did an arms embargo. Do you remember that? Well, yeah. So the Georgians, by the way, they didn't have spare parts to even train their soldiers, train with our equipment, which was then became their equipment, to go to fight side by side with our soldiers. And it was Republicans who consistently said, that's crazy, right? Now there's a relatively small number of Republicans who are now saying that we should not help the Ukrainians stop, defeat Putin. And here's my fear. If somebody is out there saying that they're going to take the Baltics and, you know, Lithuania and, I mean, and all the way through Poland, and then he starts doing it, we should take it pretty seriously. It's costly. But you know what would be a lot more costly? If the Ukrainians don't stop Putin now, I fear that Putin, as he has stated, will not stop there. And then we're talking a totally different issue. And then we're talking about, you know, NATO, Article 5. And people think it's expensive to stop Putin, that the Ukrainians stopping Putin is expensive. Imagine how expensive it would be if Putin is allowed to win. And so I do not believe, I think that we should do everything always to not be in a situation where we're forced to go to war. But appeasement and weakness always leads to war. And so, yeah, there's been a small group that has changed their position. They have the right to do so. I respect that. But I will tell you that I think they're dead wrong. Let me restate. If a few years ago when you guys were in the White House, you imagine if our military would have come to you and me and said, hey, guys, if you give me, pick a number, $100 billion, $200 billion, crazy number, we can wipe out most of the Russian military. We can wipe out a lot of their equipment, and we can do that without the loss of American life. You know what I would have said? Where do I sign? Where do I sign, right? And so there are some folks, it's not the majority, there are some folks that do not want to help the Ukrainians. They have the right to do that. I think it's a terrible mistake.
What I've experienced when we've met with members of Congress, Republican members of Congress, asking them about why they haven't supported aid to Ukraine, what we found is many of them say, essentially, I understand it, I get it. What I'm worried about is my constituents. They don't get it, they don't understand it. Our response is often, right, you're a member of Congress, this is sort of part of your responsibility is to help advocate for these things that are important. How do your constituents sort of react to your voting record on Ukraine? Is it something that has hurt you in any way? Or like, how do you make the case to them as to why this matters when obviously there are so many other domestic issues that they're affected by as well?
The Ukraine, like, look, I'm a firm believer that the world in the United, as I said, is safer when the United States leads. And unfortunately, when, you know, vacuums, you know, right, this is one of those universal truths, vacuums are filled. And if the United States doesn't lead, and if we just decide that we're going to retract entirely, those vacuums will be filled. And in Asia, you know who's going to fill the vacuum, right? It's going to be China. In Europe, what we see, Putin. In Latin America, it's going to be, you know, Castro and with Maduro's money, Venezuelan money stolen by Maduro. You name it, right? And so in the Middle East, it'll be Iran. And so the question is it in our best interest to be in a world where that happens? And so twofold on that, 2 points. Number one is I think I have a responsibility to not waste money. I am not apologetic about being a fiscal, can I say hard ass? I'm not apologetic about being a fiscal hard ass, about trying not to waste money, about trying to spend less money. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that in the bill, the State Foreign Operations Appropriation Bills, after we negotiated with the White House and the Senate, 6% less money spent than last year. But having spent 6% less, we're doing a lot more, a lot better things with less money. I'm not apologetic about that. So I think the key is showing the people that you are not wasting money, showing that it's an important issue that we have to spend money on. Nobody wants to do foreign aid or spend money abroad. But what history has reminded us time and time and time again is that, again, those vacuums are filled. I would argue, that money that we are spending, if we do it wisely, if we're not blowing money, if we're not misspending money, if we're not spending money on organizations that are not doing things in our best interest, we can talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of that going on. But I think if you show the American people that you're doing it efficiently, effectively, the American people do understand that that it's in our best interest. And again, I do not want to spend money on foreign aid. This is going to sound a little crass. You know, we always want to help people, right? But the reality is, I think I have a responsibility to support and defend the national security interests of the United States. That's what my colleagues have put me in this position to do. And to me, foreign policy is just not that complicated. It really isn't. And I've been very open about this. If you are an ally of the United States and you're helping our national security interests, I want to try to help you. But, and by the way, even if you're a controversial ally, I'm going to try to help you. I use as an example, by the way, you know, was FDR right during World War II to, in essence, jump in bed with one of history's most, one of history's villains, Stalin? I would argue, by the way, it was the right thing to do, right? Why? Because at that moment, it was in our national security interest. So if you're an ally of the United States, I'm going to try to help you. If you're an adversary of the United States, or if you are hurting our national security interests, even if you're a sacred cow, or if you are helping our adversaries, or if you are targeting our allies, my issue is I don't give a damn if you received money in the past. I don't give a damn if you're a sacred cow. Over my dead body, am I going to put taxpayer money in those areas? So I think if you show that to the American people, they'll support you.
So it's interesting what you described about sort of your approach to the budget, because so regularly we see people talking about, you know, either being a defense, we call it hawk, I guess you could say hard ass, a defense hawk or a budget hawk. And you sort of described how you're both.
Yeah.
And so how do you, as chair of, you know, Senate Foreign Ops, how do you kind of balance
House,
those?
House Foreign Ops. House Foreign Ops.
I'm too young
to be in the
yet.
Senate still.
Sorry. House
That's
Foreign
Elliot.
Ops.
He's the guy who could be in the Senate.
How do you kind of balance those two things?
Because you can do both things. There are certain things that you have to do to protect your national security interests. You want to do it as potentially cheaply, as efficiently, and as effective as possible. And so how do you do that? Look, let me tell you, like, you know, one of the sacred cows that we finally got rid of. One of the things that I'm very proud of in this state foreign office is we've actually defunded things entirely that have been sacred cows. UNRWA. UNRWA, you know, the Israelis have been telling them for years, hey, man, you know, like, the you got issues here, right? I mean, you're teaching people in their schools to hate Jews, to kill Jews. And they've basically denied it. And you know what's even worse than that? That the world has denied that. And we've known that, right? And so, you know, then you have this horrific attack, you know, the largest murder of Jews since the Holocaust, right? And then, you know, you would think that, well, the fact that you've got an organization funded, you know, UN organization, which receives US funding that, you know, teaches a hatred of Jews, that would be enough to cut the funding, but no, it wasn't. Then you think, oh, the fact that employees of UNRWA went into Israel and killed Jews on that horrible day in October, you think that'd be enough? That's not enough. All right, well, maybe, hell, how about if maybe, like, you know, that there's a Hamas tunnel underneath the UNRWA headquarters with electricity connected from, right? So you would think that that would be an easy sell. I will tell you, we had to fight almost to the end, and I give a lot of credit to the speaker, because we were saying, over my dead body, over our dead body, are we going to continue to fund this organization that is no longer, it's not helping our national security interests or Israel's, it's actually hindering and hurting us. And so those are the kind of things that you have to do. And so that 6% less overall spending, I will tell you, we're doing a lot more to confront China. We're doing a lot more to confront the enemies of the United States and of freedom. We're doing a lot more to help our allies, but we're doing it with overall less money by, frankly, stop wasting money and shifting the money into the things that are essential. That's what I did in the state legislature. They called me the slasher and when I chaired the Appropriations Committee in the state legislature. And right now, I think we have to show that we can do it. Fund your priorities, but do it efficiently. Don't waste money. And stop funding organizations, or frankly, even countries, that have been receiving money and that it's controversial to cut. And so you just got to be willing to make those tough decisions. To me, they're not tough decisions. They're kind of common sense decisions, right?
It's interesting. On UNRWA, one of the things that I was most, I shouldn't say surprised, because I don't think I was surprised by it, but there was recently a report that UNRWA said, and the UN specifically said, that they would not cooperate with this maritime pier that the Biden administration has proposed, because that would require them to collaborate with the Israelis. And it's like, yeah, well, but you were fine with collaborating directly with Hamas. So it just sort of...
That's consistent, because just one example. They're doing this. Right, they do this all the time. Yeah.
So I want to talk about another sort of key foreign policy. Well, it's foreign and domestic, which is the border. Mm-hmm. It's obviously something that has come up today as well. Yep. This question over, you know, where are all the border provisions? You were one of the lead Republicans to introduce H.R. 2, which was the Secure the Border Act. One of the sort of most, I think, sort of important pieces of legislation on border security. So what can Congress do now to try to get more attention paid to the border? And what do you think is sort of like a realistic outcome?
Yeah, look, I think the American people now finally understand that we have a serious crisis. And I hate to put it in these terms, but if you get classified briefings about some of the folks that we know have come across the border, we are sitting on a ticking time bomb in this country, literally. And, you know, without getting into the details, but you've seen it, right, publicly. You've seen the thousands of military-age Chinese males that have come across the border. You know, you've seen folks from the Middle East that have come across the border. And I will tell you that we're sitting on a ticking time bomb. And it's not rocket science, right? I think the American people now are starting to realize, maybe not that aspect of it, but the fact that it's unsustainable. You know, the real sad part, the folks who are getting hurt, I mean, obviously our national security is getting hurt. But the irony is that when President Biden, through executive order, in essence, threw open the border, remember, the law has not changed. What changed is the attitude of the president, who's in the White House now. And he said that he wanted a more humane policy. Let me tell you you all know what's going on. It is not humane that the vast majority of women and girls are sexually abused. And we know that. That's not humane. That's inhuman. That's savage. It is not humane that children and girls and women are being trafficked by the narco cartels. They're being trafficked on the way here, and they're being trafficked when they're here. And the federal government is complicit in that. That's not humane. That's savage. It is not humane that the system is now in such shambles that folks who have a potential real, credible, may have a potential credible asylum case, good luck trying to get that case actually through the process. So it is the most inhumane. It's a violation of, it's a threat to our national security. It is a violation of the rule of law. It is inhumane to the folks who are being trafficked, abused. It is insane that by policy, this administration has in essence given the control of the southern border, the decision about who comes across the southern border, to the Mexican narco cartels. Because I know you all know that. You've seen the bands, right? The folks wear? You seen that? So, you know, the day of somebody coming across the border and walking, you know, south from Honduras or whatever, and, you know, trying to get across the border. Now, those individuals may still exist, but those days are over. You have to go through the cartels. The cartels control who comes across the southern border. That has been done by executive order. This is multiple executive orders that the president has done. So what can we do? I'm a very proud sponsor, so there's a lot of us who worked on it, but I'm the main sponsor of H.R. 2. But here's some bad news and then some good news. if with this administration, and if we were able to put H.R. 2 and somehow the Senate were to pass H.R. 2 and the president were signing into law, the effects of that would be nothing. Sounds a little weird. It's my bill. Why do I tell you that? Because until we have somebody in the White House who wants to, frankly, enforce the laws, the current laws and the strengthened laws, it doesn't matter. And again, I end the same way I started. The law did not change. The only thing that changed is the administration. And so that's the bad news. The good news is that if we have a president who wants to enforce the law, I'm not going to do a political plug now, but if we have a president who wants to enforce the law, it's amazing what that president can do. And furthermore, I would like to make sure that the next president has even more ammunition, more ways to enforce the law, which is why I think H.R. 2 is a heck of a good beginning. But it requires presidential leadership wanting to do that. And right now, what is lacking is really more than anything else, more than the law, more than changes in law, is a president who wants to enforce the law, which is secure the southern border. I think I've been very clear. I've fought to cut spending and wasteful spending since I was in the state legislature. I continue to do that here. But I've also fought against discrimination and for human rights, right? But I'll tell you, you know what I also will not permit? Discriminating, you can't. I will not permit discriminating against the United States of America. The United States of America cannot be the only country that is not allowed to determine who that comes into this country, for God's sake. That's a very basic issue. And so I will fight like hell to secure the border, to have legislation that makes the border as secure as possible. H.R. 2 is a good beginning, but until we have a different president, that's not going to happen.
I would be remiss to not ask you about other Latin American and Caribbean issues. Given your background, Elliot mentioned coming from a Cuban family. And so we were just talking about the border, and I was speaking with David Smolensky, who is a representative now of Maria Corina Machado and previously worked at the interim government for Venezuela. He was sharing a statistic that since, I think he said 2021, there's been now 700,000 Venezuelans that have come to the United States, which is an astronomical number.
Yeah.
And I think 300,000 or so came just last year. It makes me think, and I hope your answer to this is no. So I want you to say no, but the answer might be yes. Is Venezuela becoming another Cuba?
Well, Venezuela is a narco-terrorist state, you know, which, by the way, I would argue that's the same thing Cuba is. It's a narco-terrorist state. So in that sense, yes. If the premise of the question is, are they using immigration to try to get what they want, like blackmail the administration? Potentially, could they be doing what, Castro did during the Maria Bolif with some good people came over, but they also emptied their prisons, from mental institutions. And, by the way, they didn't release the political prisoners. They didn't put political prisoners on the boat. They put, murderers and, rapists on the boat. And so could that be happening? Yeah, I without getting into details, it is happening. There are also some good people that are trying to get, to the United States because of the repression. But by the way, they also can't get their asylum cases heard now. So it's a lose-lose. So yeah, in that case, absolutely. But here's the interesting thing. As far as, blackmailing this administration to do what they do, this administration wants to give concessions unilaterally to the Maduro regime, wants to give unilateral concessions to the Castro regime. This is an administration, if I'm allowed to say this in this group, I don't know. This is an administration who has a very difficult time understanding who are our allies and who are our friends and who are our adversaries and our enemies. It seems that they treat our enemies and our adversaries better than they treat our allies. I remember when, this Biden administration first got there, I had then, brand new secretary say this was via Zoom because, we couldn't talk to each other in person. Remember those days? And I asked the secretary of state, I said, do you support keeping sanctions or strengthening sanctions to the Maduro regime. And he publicly stated in a hearing, well, Zoom hearing, he says, yes, not only do I support the current sanctions, we're going to look at ways to strengthen the sanctions. And within a very short period after that, they started unilaterally relaxing sanctions. They've done that to every enemy of the United States. Iran. Look at Iran, right? You know, the first, this nuclear deal. Because the Iranian mullahs, by the way, they want nuclear technology because they want to provide cheap electricity to the Iranian people. I mean, we chuckle, right? It is so absurd. And yet we're supposed to believe that? The only reason Iran is pursuing a nuclear program is for nuclear weapons, period. That's it. And yet, you know, the Obama administration and this administration, you know, have continued to try to appease that regime, bales of cash, not enforcing sanctions. You've seen what their, if you look at their foreign, the reserves, right? The cash reserves, they're escalating. If you look at this, the just the barrels of oil that they used to be able to sell under when you guys were there and President Trump was in the White House to now, they have all this money that they didn't have when it was, the attitude was, we're going to tighten and we're going to squeeze them. We're going to make sure that they can't have access to currency. And you want to know what the Iranian regime did with that money? These guys saw the rockets and the missiles. You know, that's what happens. And so, yeah, this attitude of appeasing our enemies, of giving unilateral sanction relief, hoping that they're going to get nicer, they're going to become good guys. And by the way, if at least it was consistent, but it's not, because if you're an ally of the United States vis-a-vis Israel, or name it, this administration looks at ways to pressure you. But if you're an enemy of the United States, there is no unilateral concession. There's no measure of appeasement that they don't try to pursue. And so that's been kind of our battle as chairmanship of this subcommittee. My attitude was just the opposite. If you're an ally, as I told you, I want to help you. If you're an adversary or you're hurting our allies, I'm going to try to figure out ways how I can hurt you. I think that attitude would be really, really helpful if we had that same attitude in the White House. And so, no, they're going to continue to give sanction relief. They may not say it, but they can continue to do so. And they're doing it to Venezuela. They're doing it to the Castro regime. They've done it with Iran, you name it. And so I end that long, 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 long answer to end with this. Elections have consequences. And we're going to be dealing with the consequences of the positions and the policies that we're living under right now for decades and decades to come.
I'm going to ask one more question and then open it up to the audience. And this is something that I've been thinking a lot about. You know, in the United States, we talk a lot about the military recruitment crisis. Mm-hmm. But something that we've noticed at Vandenberg, we have as one of our missions to try to encourage the sort of next generation of leaders and a few programs to try to do that. This is sort of one of those programs. It strikes me, I'm looking at just your family. You come from, you know, your father was a Cuban politician. You're an American politician. Your brother Lincoln, who I had the opportunity to meet once.
Just shows we're not that smart. We don't learn. You know?
Also a member of Congress. Other brother, successful banker. Other brother, successful journalist. Obviously, you know, you all came over here and had enormous success, but that success was rooted in what seems to be a very clear commitment to this country and patriotism. And I wonder, as you look at this sort of next generation of people, what are the things that maybe your parents helped teach you about that inspired you to care so much about the country that you would dedicate your life to service? And how might we be able to spread that message and encourage more people to enter public service in the way that you and your family have?
Well, that was an easy question. look, you know, my family is incredibly blessed, right? You're right. You know, my parents, Cuban exiles, the two oldest brothers were born in Cuba. The two youngest brothers, I'm the youngest of four, and were born at four, and the youngest of four, and I was born in the United States, the two youngest ones. But we are really just incredibly fortunate that my family landed in the greatest nation in the history of this world. And I'm not apologetic about that. it's a human endeavor, and so therefore it's not going to be perfect. But it is the most perfect. This is the most generous, the most open, the most perfect country and society in the history of this planet. And as a Hispanic, and I don't care if you're, pick your group du jour, right? If you're Hispanic, if you're Black, if you're a woman, if you're gay, if you're a Muslim, if you are a Christian, if you're a Jew, if you're a, you name it, if you're blonde, if you're not blonde, where else in this planet does anybody, a woman, a Jew, a Muslim, a Hispanic, a Black, where else in this planet does anybody have less discrimination, more opportunity than in the United States? Nowhere. Nowhere. And so when you say that, we're just incredibly blessed that we're here. And I think we recognize how blessed and lucky we are. And, you know, I used to chair this thing called the Transatlantic Legislative Dialogue, which was, we meet with European members of parliament all the time. And you know what some of my European parliamentary colleagues would say to me all the time? They say, Mario, do you realize, like, this phenomenon that is an American phenomenon? It's not a democratic, little d, it's not a democracy phenomenon, it's not a capitalist phenomenon, it's not a Western phenomenon. Social mobility. Do you realize the social mobility that exists in the United States? That doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. You have examples in other parts of the world, but here we take it for granted, right? We take it for granted that it doesn't matter what your background is, where you came from, what you looked like, what religion you practice or none, that in this country, if you work hard and you sacrifice, and maybe you won't be able to do it, but your kids will. And we take that for granted. That's why my family has done well. It's not because of us. It's because the United States of America. That's why we've done well. And I think people who have lost their countries, who have lost freedom, who have experienced bad things, those are the first that understand that this place here, the United States of America, this is the best place in the whole world, for God's sake. And so that message, I think we need to continue to demonstrate and to talk about. My fear is that, you know, how do you get, you talked about recruitment for the military, right? Look, how do you get future generations to stand up and to, you know, actually be willing to serve this country, including putting their lives on the line, if they are taught from the day they're born to every single day that the United States is evil, it's racist, it's an immoral society. When the fact is, it is just the opposite. This is not a racist country. This is the most anti-racist country ever, anywhere. This is not a country, an imperialistic country. This is a country that has sent troops around the world to free people. And the only thing we have kept is that land to bury our dead, right? And so that message has to continue to be taught. And so the folks that don't really need to be taught are the ones who have experienced other places that, in some folks in Hollywood, tell us that those are the ideal places, right? And the United States is evil. No, BS. This country, and I'm unapologetic about it, this is the greatest freaking country in the history of this planet. And imagine being in a position to be able to fight for that, to try to preserve that and improve on that. Oh my God, I'm the luckiest guy in the whole world.
Thank you so much. Okay, we are going to, yes, I think that deserves a lot of applause. Yeah. And we're very lucky to have you as a member of Congress. Questions for Congressman Diaz-Balart? Sophie, we'll go around to Dan. And just introduce yourself and your organization if you'd like.
I'm Dan Pollack with the Zionist Organization of America. We really thank you for the work you did in this latest round of appropriations for foreign organizations. The question I have is, you had tremendous success in succeeding at overcoming the intrinsic opposition of especially people in the Senate towards cutting any funding at the UN at all. What is your view now of the UN? It seems still to be a very anti-American organization. The Secretary General routinely makes things that anyone, statements that anyone in the world would say are anti-Semitic, if they were being honest.
Yeah.
It's just one thing after another there. Is there still hope that the UN can somehow be reformed? Or is our future to just keep the pressure on and fiscal pressure is the one thing we have going for us there?
Look, is there hope? I'm not a sociologist, and I will tell you that I think I have, thank God, I'm in a position to be able to try to make a difference. I've told folks in the UN, without getting into specifics, but the highest level, that if they want me to take them seriously, they have to start by taking themselves seriously, right? You can't have a human rights commission made up of the worst human rights violators and pretend that we're supposed to continue to fund that. You can't, be just have this crazy, psychotic focus on criticizing Israel while at the same time, having, again, whether it's the UN, Human Rights Council or whatever, and expect me to continue to support sending you money, right? So one of the things I'm very proud of, and thank you for those kind words, is we've gotten probably the strongest real serious reforms on the UN that we've ever gotten, by the way, through the State Foreign Ops Bill. By the way, we defunded UNRWA, right? We basically are now holding back the funds for the UN Human Rights Council until they do some serious reforms. Let's see if they can get there. But if not, we're holding back those funds. We defunded the Commission on Inquiry on Israel, right? We defunded it. And again, those reforms, including some of the reforms, which, by the way, have not gotten a lot of coverage, which I get it because they're not sexy, but like insisting that we have the ability, the Department of State auditors, to be able to actually look at the books. I know that sounds like really? We haven't been able to do that? No. And by the way, because we never were serious about actually doing it, right? And the way I was able to get those reforms is by holding back money. And then in those negotiations, it's like, oh, you want money? You're going to have to take some of my reforms. So, the good news is that's the basis to start negotiations for the next year. That's the starting point. That's not the end point. And we need to do a lot more to reform. And the way to do that is by using purse strings, right? In a way that's smart, because it doesn't help us just to yell. We actually have to be able to move things forward, right? And so I'm very pleased with that. Do they have hope? I don't know, frankly. I really don't know. There are some things that they do, which are pretty good. Some subsets that they do, and we have consistently continued to fund some of those things. But for example, let me give you an example. Some peacekeeping efforts that they do are positive. But even there, and something that I think is a worthwhile endeavor, we insisted on following the law. Novel concept, right? The law states, U.S., that the U.S. should not spend more than 25% of that. Well, we consistently violated that. So I don't know if there's hope for the U.N., but whether there is or there isn't, I think it is upon us as Americans and my role, and hopefully we'd get some help from the administration and the Senate, which, we haven't, but to make sure that we use whatever leverage we can to incentivize them to do the right thing, to reform. And if they do not reform, I, for one, think that just because we've been funding it in the past doesn't mean we should be funding it in the future. And so, again, none of this is rocket science, right? And so I'm going to continue to do that. I'm very happy that we passed these appropriation bills, because otherwise we would have been stuck with the other ones that had none of these reforms, that funded UNRWA, that funded the Commission on Inquiry on Israel. So we're in a much better starting point, but I want to remind you, that's just a starting point. We have to continue those efforts because I'm just not willing, because otherwise we're just wasting money. Not only are we wasting money, but we're actually funding things that are not only not helping our national security interests or that of our allies, that actually is hurting our national security interests and that of our allies, and using our own money to do so Hell no.
Other questions? Let's do Stephen, and then we'll come back around here. Sorry, I picked the worst location for your selfie.
Hi, Stephen Moore. I'm with the Ukraine Freedom Project. I'm a former House Republican chief of staff who's been in Ukraine since day five of the war. And, you know, we do a lot of work on Russian propaganda because the Russian propaganda machine is breathtaking. By some estimates, the Russians are spending $2.5 billion globally on propaganda. And I know some of your colleagues, some of your fellow chairmen have commented that on that there's a lot of Russian propaganda that's infiltrating the Republican Party. And, you know, and there's a lobbyist right now on Capitol Hill that is being paid by a Russian oligarch to tell members of Congress that Zelensky and the Ukrainian government are persecuting Christians. And so I just wanted to, this is true. Yeah. And it's documented. This is paid for by the Russians. And so I just wanted to get your sense of that. What are you seeing in the propaganda world? What is, you know, in your budget, the foreign ops budget, I would think would have a lot of counter propaganda stuff in it. What are you seeing? What's effective? What's the federal government doing?
No, we actually do. Now I'll tell you one of the things that we've done in the state foreign ops bill, and you know, we're in the process of trying to figure out how we can move forward to get a supplemental to help our national security interests. By the way, in Europe, in Asia, and the Middle East, which I think we need to do, by the way. But one of the things that we did, and I'm very proud of, is that we have additional measures in our bill dealing with a Ukraine on accountability. Because, as I mentioned before, I think it's important that I think we should be helping the Ukrainians defeat and stop Putin. I don't want to sound crass, but better them than us, you know. But I also think that we need to make sure that we have real accountability. One of the things that, for example, we have in there is you should be able to put this stuff on the internet. The American people should be able to see where the money's going, how it's being spent. And I'm very proud of that. And so, you know, as we're working through this process of trying to, you know, get some funding to fight and to confront our adversaries, our enemies now that we need to do more on, more of, I didn't say more on, I said more of, it's more, yeah, two words. I think accountability is key. And so as far as the Russians have been very, very effective. And one of the things that I said in conference a couple of days ago, yesterday, you know, I also, as you all know, it's not like we don't know who Putin is. The Russian influence and involvement in Europe and in this hemisphere should scare anybody and everybody who's looked at it, who's seen it, right? The fact that, you know, don't take my word for it, but the Chinese and the Russians talk about their strategic alliance. And you see that, right? But that strategic alliance that Russia has is not only with China. It's with China, it's with Iran. It's with all of the enemies of the United States. And wherever you see in this hemisphere, for example, Russia, you see China and you see Iran, right? And but they are very good at their propaganda machine. I, for one, by the way, don't spend a lot of time listening to talking heads. I do spend a lot of time researching, talking to folks who are there, looking at what they're doing, because I'm less concerned about what people say than I am about what people do. And there should be no doubt as to who Putin is. His intentions have been clear from day one, and his actions have demonstrated that what he has been saying he means. You know, I focus more on that. And I'm obviously always concerned about propaganda. We do have increased funding. Wow. Did I mention that we're spending 6% less? Did I mention that overall? But we put more funding, by the way, for example, for broadcasting, because we don't have to match Russia and China, but we can't leave that space entirely open, because then again, bad things happen.
I would also just add on the Ukraine accountability point. I was recently in Ukraine, and there were sort of two key messages that they were sending us. The Ukrainian government was sending us. One was deep gratitude for the contributions that the U.S. had already made. The second was even deeper gratitude for those conditions for accountability, yeah. because the reformers and the whistleblowers and so on, it is so useful and beneficial for them to have that. So it was a clear message of appreciation for everything that you and your colleagues have done on that front. Let's go over here.
Thank you, Congressman, for a very inspirational message. I'm Joe Bosco, formerly with the Defense Department. If the Congress were to enact the kinds of reforms you're talking about, or if the UN were to reform, particularly with accountability, would that satisfy your colleagues' criticism of the Ukraine project?
Wow. I can't speak for my colleagues on things like that. What I will tell you that some yes, others no. But I think there's very strong support among. Look, if you talk to the folks on the Intelligence Committee, on Armed Services, on Appropriations, Defense, you know, on Foreign Affairs, if you talk to the Republicans who actually have pretty much on a constant basis access to real information, there's really very little separation between us. Now, as Republicans, we all want to be efficient. We don't want to waste money. We'd like to spend less money where we can. But I think there's an understanding as to who and what we're dealing with when we're dealing with Putin. And so I don't know what would satisfy. My emphasis on accountability is because I am an unapologetic fiscal hawk. I do not like misspending money. I do not like wasting money. But I also understand that there are some things that we need to do in order to strengthen our national security. And so I think the vast majority of Republicans have, in essence, that kind of attitude. And the more you see and hear and learn about Putin, the more I think you realize that that this is one of those individuals, and we've seen those throughout history, right? Where appeasement has not worked, and I'd rather him be stopped now, as opposed to having a NATO confrontation. And so I think the vast majority of my colleagues, Republican colleagues, believe that. But I can't speak for all.
Okay, we're going to take just two more questions probably. So we'll go over here to Ralph first and then over here. And if we have time, we'll take another one. So.
Thank you. Ralph Winnie with the Eurasia Center. Could you comment on what you think the U.S. should be doing to engage China to bring them closer into our orbit, recognizing that they could be a potential threat, but wanting to move them away from engaging and allying with the Russians? What is the Biden administration doing well, and what should they be doing better to bring China to our orbit?
A couple points. First place, I firmly believe that Reagan got it right, peace through strength. Appeasement doesn't work. The way to not have a war is for everybody to understand that you have the toughest, the strongest, the most capable military, and that if you need to, you'll be willing to use it. I don't want a strong defense to go to war. I want the strongest defense to avoid having to use it, right? So with China, I think, again, appeasement has never worked. If you're Xi and you see what happened in Afghanistan, I think you've got to be asking yourself the question, are they really going to help if we do something in Taiwan? Right. By the way, I think the issue of Ukraine is something that the Chinese have to be looking at as well. Right. So I think first it's important to understand, as I mentioned before, who your allies and your adversaries are. I would argue that China's intentions have been very clear. They are not a bigger Costa Rica. They're not India. They are, I think, a potentially very, very dangerous adversary. They are very aggressive. They're pushing the boundaries. And I think throughout history, you see that when you have that kind of attitude, so that you don't end up having a misunderstanding and are forced to go to war, you have to make sure that you push back. And so I'm a firm believer that we can be a lot tougher on China, that we have to take them very, very seriously. There was always an approach, pretty much bipartisan, and I understand, you know, I support what Nixon did when he did it with China. But I think then there was this kind of like wishful thinking that if we just did business with them, that they would be, you know, they would realize that capitalism is great and the people would become wealthy and then they'd all be good guys and everything else. And what we failed to realize is that in a dictatorship like that, it doesn't matter what the people think. It is the dictatorship that has been strengthened. And that investment has in essence created the wealthiest fascist or communist dictatorship on the planet. And so I think we have to be a lot tougher. I think we need to show a lot more resolve. I think we need to make sure that we keep them out of industries and, you know, areas that have national security implications. Not because I want confrontation, but just because of the opposite, because I think it's important that that the Chinese dictatorship understand that we're serious. But in order to do that, by the way, we also are going to have to spend a lot more in defense than we're spending right now. One of the things that the Ukraine war has shown us is that our industrial base, our defense industrial base, is nowhere near where we need to be. I'm hoping that we will get over the days, which we are now, by the way, on a bipartisan level, having defense as a number. Defense is not a number. Defense is, we got to get that right. We got to do what we have to do, understanding that our potential adversary is China. And then we'll figure out how to pay for the rest of the stuff, right? So I think, again, to sum it up, peace through strength. Appeasement has never worked in the history of this planet. And I think that's the best way to hopefully avoid a military confrontation with a regime that obviously feels that it can continue to push and get away with it. It obviously believes that the United States right now is either unable or unwilling to push back. That's a dangerous place to be.
All right. So our last question, we'll make it a quick one. And try to make it an optimistic one if you can.
It would be very optimistic, yes. Paweł Burdze, I'm from Washington, D.C., Office of Polish Institute for International Affairs. This is first Polish think tank with the shop in D.C. First of all, optimistic comment. As a Polish-American, I would like you comment for what you said about America. I agree with you 100%, born and raised in communist Poland, 100% agree with you. Now, that tougher questions. About this Ukraine bill. I know the plan A is to pass it separately. Is it possible to be passed by weekend? And if not, there is a plan B, of course, which is called discharge petition. Are you willing to sign it and just to make things done?
Good question.
Basically,
by the way, we're like on we're not on plan A. We're like on plan like double Z right now, and so we're now going through the Greek. You know, we're going to find a different alphabet. You know, look, on the discharge petition, I have never nor will I in the majority sign a discharge petition. That has been my attitude. Are there enough people out there who I think if they see that this is absolutely frozen that will sign that discharge petition? I think there are. The speaker has been very clear. The speaker has been very clear that he does not want to let Putin get away with what he's doing. The speaker has put forward now different options to pursue. The last option that he put on the table, which by the way is hard to argue against its fairness, was that we're going to have different votes in the Pacific, on Ukraine, on Israel, etc. people can vote however they want to, and then whatever happens, we'll put it together and send it to the Senate. And by the way, that we'll also have amendments available to all those issues, which is precisely what some of the people who are now mad at the speaker have always said they wanted. But I'm reminded that that when we had a different speaker, Kevin McCarthy, some of the folks that actually decided to, the Republicans that decided to take him out, I heard a couple of them publicly say that one of the reasons they took him out was because then Speaker McCarthy didn't bring the appropriation bills to the floor. I'm an appropriator. I love the fact that people wanted to bring the appropriation bills to the floor. But some of those individuals who publicly stated that that was among the main reasons why they took out the speaker were the ones who voted against the rule to allow the appropriation bills to get to the floor in the first place. So that's the situation that we find ourselves in. I think we're going to be able to bring bills to the floor that help Israel in their time of great need, that help the Ukrainians stop Putin so that we won't have to do it, or, you know, the Poles, NATO won't have to do it, right? I think there are ways to do that, and the speaker wants to do that. I think the vast majority of Republicans want to do that. I think a heck of a lot of Democrats want to do that. But when you have such a very slim majority, it's very difficult to get anything done. But I will leave you with this positive note, which is, as of now, a speaker who, frankly, not a lot of people knew about before he became speaker, who I will tell you is exceedingly bright. He is upfront. And I would not bet against Speaker Johnson getting done what he wants to get done. I think he believes that it is in the national security interests of the United States. And I happen to agree with him. And so I am optimistic that we're going to get it done. You asked if it can be done this week. I don't have an answer to that. A lot of things are dependent on what happens in the next couple of days. But I would not bet against the speaker, because the vast majority of Republicans in the House want to get this done. And so therefore, I think ultimately the will of the House will prevail. And if that's the case, if the will of the House prevails, I think you're going to have a very healthy bill to help Israel, to help stop Putin, to help Taiwan and confront China. And all of that, by the way, goes back to the original premise. It is the national security interests of the United States that has to be our number one consideration. And I'm very confident that ultimately those issues will prevail.
Congressman, thank you so much for joining us, for your leadership.
Was I long-winded enough?
No, that was perfect.
I get that.
That was perfect. Thank you so much joining us. Thank you all for joining us as well. We host this series to try to speak to conservative members of Congress, conservative governors, conservative thought leaders on what their ideas are for how we can advance American security, American national interest. So we hope you will join us for future events as well. Thank you so much again.
Thank you all.
Appreciate it.
Thank you all.